From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. South Africa is known as the Rainbow Nation, country of Nelson Mandela that peacefully transitioned from apartheid to democracy. It's also Africa's economic powerhouse, and its relative wealth and stability has drawn millions of migrants from elsewhere in Africa. But the new arrivals have tested South Africa's unity. In recent weeks, the country has been the scene of deadly mob attacks against immigrants from other African nations. Earlier this month, 12 people were killed and thousands forced from their homes in a wave of attacks on immigrant neighborhoods near Johannesburg. Now, this kind of violence has happened periodically for more than a decade now. Many of South Africa's neighbors are angry. After the most recent attacks, Nigeria recalled its ambassador and boycotted an economic meeting in South Africa. Zambia and Madagascar both canceled sporting events with South African teams. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at South Africa's xenophobia problem and how it relates to rising anti-foreigner sentiment in the U.S. and Europe. To kick things off, we're going to bring in Daniel Byamungu Dunya. He's a Congolese immigrant living in Durban and leads a group that advocates for immigrants in South Africa called the African Solidarity Network. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. How are you?
Well, thank you for joining us. If you could start out by telling us how you came to live in South Africa in the first place.
Yes, I came to South Africa in 2006 when there was war in DRC, and I decided to come here to seek for refugee.
Okay, so there's that was at the time of a major war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and so you came as a refugee to South Africa, and you settled there. And I understand that in 2015, you were living in a place called Isipingo near the city of Durban, at a time when there was a lot of anti-foreigner sentiment and there were some riots and you got caught up in the violence. Talk to us about this.
That's correct. In 2006, there was a speech made by the King, Goodwill Zwelithini. And when he made a speech, he said that foreigners must leave.
I'm sorry, this is the King of the Zulus, like the traditional leader of the Zulu people.
Yes, that's correct. And then people took upon themselves the law in their hand, and they were going shop by shop, attacking all foreigners. And unfortunately, this attack started the area where I've been living. In Isipingo, we've been attacked, my shop were looted, and we ran away, went to the police station. From the police station, went to the camp, where we spent almost 6 months in the shelter.
I'm sorry if I could just back you up a little bit then. So you had to flee your shop. Your shop was looted that you had in Isipingo, and you wound up going to sleep at a police station for several nights.
Yes, when things was bad, we all of us moved and went to the police station in Isipingo police station. There we slept two nights at the police station, and then they took us from there back to the shelter where the government was providing services.
Okay, so the government had set up, like, actually, there were so many people displaced, the government had set up some sort of almost like internal refugee camps.
That's correct. There were more than 3,000 people who was a victim and were in the shelter, or how we call it, a camp, where we spent almost like 6 months while the government was trying to negotiate with people so we can go back to the communities.
Okay, and What happened to the people that were involved in this violence that chased you out of this neighborhood? Were many of them, were they jailed or were they convicted of crimes?
Very unfortunately that the government went and negotiated with them and they allow us to come back. But all those who've been arrested, no one was convicted. So people, they were arrested and a few days they were released. And yeah, that is the scenario in South Africa. When there's a xenophobic attack, people are arrested. We see the big number, but no one is convicted. So is the same happened in 2015.
And so when you look at what happened here just a few weeks ago in South Africa, it sounds like there's a lot of similarities between what's just happened earlier in September and what happened to you in 2015.
That's correct. And the challenge is that the government doesn't have any plan of action to deal with this xenophobic attack. They just push statement and apologizing on TV, but on the grassroots, on the ground, there's nothing to mitigate it. And perpetrators are not convicted. You hear the number, 600 people are arrested, but these people are not convicted and spend their time in jail. So nothing will change if these people are not convicted properly.
Okay, so these were 600 people that were just arrested after the most recent violence, but have been released, and you're concerned that they won't face justice for what they've done. But I wanted to ask you, what is the feeling among you and the other immigrants that you work with there about your situation?
The feeling, we're all living in fear, and we can see that the government is not able to address this issue because it's not 2008 up to date. And the worst part of it, government doesn't have any plan to mitigate or any plan of action on the ground to deal with it. So we are living in really big fear of xenophobic attack, and it can happen anytime. Like last night, yesterday, there was an attack in one of the areas in KwaZulu-Natal, in Umlaas, next to my house. The attack shop belonged to Ethiopian Somalis. They banned the shop, and one person was banned inside the shop. So you can see government just making a statement, but nothing is happening to address it. As I'm saying, last night there was attack on foreign nationals in Umlaazi, in KwaZulu-Natal.
Okay, so these attacks are ongoing. Sometimes they're localized, and so they're not always making the news. But talk to us about how does xenophobia affect you in your daily life? Like these violent attacks aside, do you also feel that there's some other resentment of foreigners from people around you?
Actually, the sentiment, because the way the politicians are presenting foreigners as criminals, a drug lord, and so on and so on, it's giving us a very bad impression. Even the neighborhood, the treatment we are receiving from the neighborhood is not adequate because people, they start assimilating everyone who's not South African to a criminal, and that makes us unsafe. Even in the public transport, you're in the taxi, you fear to speak your language, even though you have documentation, because of everyone who perceives that foreigners are illegal in the country, are criminals, which is not the case.
Well, Daniel, our time grows short, but do you have any, are there some reasons to be optimistic that this situation may improve in the next few years?
I don't think that the situation will improve. And the reason why I have doubt and I don't believe that there will be improvement is that if there is no program of action to deal with issue of xenophobia or to mitigate xenophobia, you can't expect change to come from heaven. Making a media statement is not going to bring change. This is of social people mentality of change. People have different view toward migrants. So if you want to change that, we need to have programs of action which will be able to change people's behavior and understand why migrants and foreigners are in the country. Otherwise, nothing will change. So for me, I believe that there's nothing which will change in the near future because there's no program of action from the government side.
Well, Daniel Dunia, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the recent deadly attacks on immigrants living in South Africa. Now, up next, we're going to bring in someone who lived through the deadliest attack on foreigners in post-apartheid South Africa. This is Alice Wamundia. She was originally from Rwanda and fled the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s, only to be caught up in mob attacks on foreigners in 2008 that killed a total of 62 people. She now works with a refugee education called the Unity for Tertiary Refugee Students in Cape Town. Alice, welcome.
Thank you, Jason. Lovely to be here.
Well, Alice, it's a pleasure to have you. Tell us a little bit about your story. As I mentioned, you came from Rwanda to South Africa in the 1990s. How were you received?
The reception was actually quite ambivalent. So to explain, educated people that I came across, my family and I came across. So, for instance, in schools, police services, et cetera, those people are quite understanding and seem to understand what the status of refugee meant. But in the townships where one stayed, being the lone foreigner in that sense, people would be quite hostile and fearful about who we were at that time, because we're one of the earliest immigrants, or rather refugees, coming to South Africa then.
And I mentioned that you and your family were affected by the 2008 riots. What happened to you?
Well, we stayed in a township, so one of these historically black areas, apartheid designated areas. And we were the only black, we were the only foreigners, if I may use that word, in that particular area. So everybody knew us. We didn't speak the language. And when the attack started, we started getting warnings, anonymous warnings and messages left on our doorsteps. You know, you gotta go back. We're coming for you. this item that you own, I'm claiming it. I'm gonna come and collect it now that you're gonna go. We tried to brush it aside, but then, you know, neighbors would come at night and say, look, I don't want to be seen during the day, but I want to tell you these people are serious. They've had a meeting, a street committee meeting, and they're going to definitely come in and get you. So the crisis came when we went to church about 20 minutes from where we used to stay. And on the way back, a mob, about 30 people had gathered outside and had waited for us. And they started chasing us around. So we managed to get away from them, got to the house, locked ourselves in, and eventually in the night we snuck away and went to stay with a family friend that had property outside the city, so somewhere away from the main the middle of the violence at the time. But it was of course very difficult because I went to school, I was at university then, just a freshman. And I remember coming to the gate of the university and the security persons, they're saying, you're one of those foreigners. No, I won't let you in. And so essentially it was everywhere in that particular.
And it sounds like in advance of the attacks, like it didn't come as a total surprise. Like you had received some warning and it sounded like it was people in your own neighborhood, maybe even that you knew or recognized, that were involved in this.
Certainly. And if I can just bring it back to the whole xenophobic experience, going back as far as 2002, because this is when this started with the Angolan refugees being attacked in townships and people being, you know, saying, no, it's not xenophobia, it's this and that. But if you look at those incidences from 2002 up until now, there's always been this sort of warnings and intimidation techniques where, you know, messages, social media, are sent. So there's sort of a grapevine where these things come out, these threats come out, and they essentially predate the actual attacks. So it's not totally surprising when it does happen because those messages do precede the events.
Well, you work with refugees now. I mean, what advice do you have for people who are newly arrived in the country?
Well, first of all, respect the laws of the country. South Africa is a very good country. I, for one, appreciate a lot of the things that and opportunities that I've received here. I definitely echo former President Jacob Zuma's words that not everybody's xenophobic, certainly not the 59 million South Africans, but they are the dangerous elements, the one apple that spoils the cart. And so as a foreigner, as a refugee coming to South Africa for the first time, respect the laws of the country, make sure you carry your documentation all the time and be very, very vigilant and careful with regards to what you do and where you go and how you do what you do.
Yes, because I think you're touching on an issue that I know you've spoken about before, which is that there is a stereotype about immigrants to South Africa that may be feeding some of this.
Yeah, look, these are old stereotypes, I think, and I don't think it's just in South Africa. I think a lot of countries think about the other as, you know, somebody that comes to steal their job, somebody that comes and brings diseases, somebody that brings criminality. But in South Africa in particular, this is very dangerous because this is used as justification for the murders, for the criminality, for the attacks that are then, you know, are launched on foreigners. So it's one thing to have stereotypes, but it's another to use them as the jumping ground to attack somebody just because they are different to you.
Well, Alice Wamundia, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Jason. It was my pleasure.
A reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're talking about xenophobia in South Africa in the wake of attacks on immigrant neighborhoods that killed a dozen people earlier this month. So for more on this issue, we're going to bring in two other people who have been following it closely. Joining us now is Dewa Mavinga, the Southern African Director for Human Rights Watch. He joins us from Cambridge, England. Now, Dewa, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jason, for having me on this show. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And also with us in the UK is Adam Harris. He's an assistant professor of political science that has researched South Africa at University College in London. Adam, welcome.
Thank you, Jason. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have both of you. If I could start with you, Dewa Mavinga, I mean, if you could just give us sort of a big picture view, why do these attacks keep recurring in South Africa?
Well, there are three reasons. One is that South Africa is one of the most unequal societies where there is abject poverty for the vast majority of black South Africans who still live in townships. And because of that, South Africa also is an economic powerhouse across Africa, which receives migrants from the rest of Africa, refugees, asylum seekers, in huge numbers when you compare with other African countries. And on top of that, you have a failure by the police in South Africa to prevent, to arrest, to investigate and prevent a recurrence of xenophobic violence. So this is why you have xenophobic violence coming in waves, because there is impunity, there is no accountability, and the poverty is getting worse. The levels of unemployment are rising. And within that context, you have political leaders using foreign nationals, migrants, particularly African migrants, as a scapegoat for the problems in South Africa in terms of lack of access to social services, in terms of the rising number, in terms of crime statistics. And this is what then drives those in communities to attack foreign nationals.
Well, Adam Harris, if I could bring you in, I mean, we heard earlier Alice Wamundia talking about some of the stereotypes of immigrants in South Africa. And of course, that sounded very familiar to people here in the United States. And I think some of these stereotypes are shared in many countries in the world. And we have seen really a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in North America, in Europe. That's even played out in some of the mass shootings as recently happened in El Paso, Texas, in New Zealand this year, that targeted immigrants. I mean, is what's happening in South Africa, is it all part of this global phenomenon, or is it something different?
I think, so it's different in a lot of ways. It's hard to think about how all these things are connected across very different contexts, but I'd say definitely so. But I think what makes the South African case unique is that, one, it's more bottom-up than top-down, where in the U.S., in the U.S. and across Europe, politicians have rallied around these things. You have Trump in the U.S., Boris Johnson in the U.K., Marine Le Pen in France, and these that have taken these sentiments and stoked the fire. Whereas in South Africa, the politicians are kind of learning from the people on the streets. They see these attacks and then see the opportunity to continue to stoke the fire and use the opportunity to scapegoat. And then another thing that is important is that immigrants present a threat to national identity. The idea of who is American, who is British, who is Danish, and so on, is very closely related to race and this idea that it's a whiteness that defines nationality there. And then so you have the influx of undesirable non-white immigrants that threaten this idea of what makes the country itself. Whereas in South Africa, the threat to national identity is not from the immigrants, it's from those who are inciting attacks. South Africa has built an identity around being inclusive, a melting pot, this rainbow nation, and has one of the most liberal constitutions in the world since 1994, in the effort to avoid any sort of discrimination that could lead to any sort of reemergence of apartheid. And so it's the people that are attacking that are threatening this idea that South Africa is a welcome place where all can be apart and respected.
Right. And I think, as Dewa mentioned, like the economic tensions are much, much greater there, it sounds like. But Dewa, if I could throw this back to you then, one aspect of this problem that I think has kind of flown under the radar, at least overseas, is that there are regular attacks on foreign truck drivers from other African countries like Zimbabwe or Zambia. Tell us a little bit about that phenomenon, because the number of people affected by this was really surprising.
Well, yes, there has been a coordinated attack on African foreign truck drivers, particularly around Durban, which is Africa's busiest and largest port. And a group of local truck drivers have begun to mobilize and have an association that is saying no to foreign truck drivers, whether or not they have a legal status, they have work permits for South Africa. And this campaign has been very violent over the last year. Since March 2018, over 200 individuals have been killed, mostly foreign truck drivers, and these have been stoned. They have had their trucks shot at, they have been tagged in gasoline bombs. So, and without any accountability, these attacks have spread across the country, but the police have not been able to thoroughly investigate and arrest. They have not been able to provide security or to guarantee the security of truck drivers. For example, I spoke to a Zimbabwean national truck driver who on the 25th of March this year was stabbed by a group of locals as the police watched, but they did not intervene to help him, and they did not arrest those involved. The people who stabbed him simply walked away. And this is characteristic of how xenophobic violence is playing out across South Africa. The police are not focused on investigations, on arrests, and on prevention of these crimes. And as a result, we keep seeing them recurring in different forms.
Well, Adam Harris, I wanted to ask you about a separate issue, too, and that was raised earlier in the program by Alice Wamundia, which I think part of what was surprising in the case of the xenophobic violence that has affected her and that I think has occurred recently is that in many cases, the people who are chased out of these neighborhoods actually knew and recognized the people who are attacking them.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, people are attacking those that are most proximate to them. There's this feeling that immigrants are not deserving, and so anything that they do have is something that I should have received first. And unfortunately, immigrants present a very identifiable group that can be easily exploited or targeted. You know, when you're in, having been in South Africa earlier this month and speaking with people, people know, you know, this is the Somali shop, this is where the Nigerians live, and so forth. And so once there's fervor or you see people starting to act and target these individuals, you know exactly where to go, and it has this kind of snowballing effect.
And I know, Adam, if you could stay with us for a second, I know that for South Africa, many of the country's big challenges are rooted in this legacy of apartheid, which, you know, we should say is a system that existed until just 25 years ago. Is there a connection between apartheid and what's happening today?
Yes, definitely. So it's only been a number of years, and South Africa is still in its infancy in democracy. But the divisions and the dividing of people and pitting them against one another is definitely still alive and well. And maybe it's easier for people to kind of look for someone to blame. But then also, I mean, one of the key legacies, and getting back to what Dewa said earlier, is unemployment and the systematic disadvantage that Black South Africans face, where 30% are unemployed, and that gives, you know, attacking or taking some sort of action to take control of one's life makes sense when one is so desperate and there are so few opportunities.
Well, Dewa, talk to us just a bit about the role of social media and even South Africa's traditional media in these attacks. How has that affected things?
Well, most of the organizing and coordination of the attacks, the spreading of messages, has been done on social media, on platforms that are easily accessible to many people in communities. And this has actually made the attacks more vicious and widespread over a very short period of time. Particularly, for example, the attacks on foreign truck drivers. Messages are sent out in advance on social media about exactly why the attacks will take place and why foreign nationals should leave a particular area. It should have also have been an opportunity for the police to investigate and prevent these attacks. But we have seen in our research across South Africa that it is actually social media which is leading to a very rapid spread of a message and a spreading of the attacks from different cities. For example, if the epicenter is Durban, within a few hours, those attacks could have spread to Cape Town, to Pretoria, to Johannesburg, primarily because of the organizing that is done on social media.
Well, Adam Harris, the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, I mean, he has apologized for these attacks. He has said they have to stop, that South Africa, it needs to heal and go through a process of healing. Of course, leaders of the country have said that after previous attacks as well. Is there some reason to believe that this time will be different?
One hopes, but as Daniel said earlier, there doesn't seem to be much meat behind this. There's not much action. There's no plan to actually combat it. So words are just words. But then also, in the same breath as you have President Ramaphosa very clearly condemning these things, the ANC comes out with an official statement that also condemns the attacks, but in the same breath says we need stronger border controls and we need to deal with the problem of illegal immigration. So at the same time, condemning it, but also equivocating and suggesting that there is some problem that these people are presenting. And so you have these tensions. And I mean, and also in the most recent attacks this month, the police minister and the police chief have also equivocated and suggested that, you know, this isn't xenophobia, this is criminality, and denying what is actually happening. So you get these mixed messages from the government that it's saying everything but also nothing at the same time, and gives room for anyone to interpret it for their own benefit.
And Dewa Mavinga, if I could just touch on with you something that was raised earlier with Daniel Dunya, and that's just the sort of question about anti-foreigner resentment sort of across society. There was an interesting essay by the CNN correspondent David McKenzie, who's South African, who said when he traveled, other South Africans would say to him, "Oh, what will you be doing while you're in Africa?" Like, there's just this sense that the rest of Africa is separate and different and apart from South Africa. Can you speak to that point?
Yes, there is a sense that, in fact, South Africa is separate, different, and in many ways superior, which then gives some kind of justification for the attacks, which is on the basis that the poor neighbors across on the African continent are coming to South Africa to take advantage unjustifiably in terms of access to jobs, in terms of, and the language is they take our wives, they take our jobs, and they have access to social services. But this is not supported by statistics and reality. It is a sentiment that is fueled also by the leadership at community level, the local councillors in the ruling parties. For example, the Johannesburg mayor has always blamed foreign nationals for crimes, for poor service delivery to communities. And this then becomes a proper justification that is then used to say, these are the people that we need to attack if we are to have proper access to services. This is not the truth, but the authorities in South Africa are not doing enough to dispel this myth. The media also in South Africa is not doing enough, because sometimes there is what appears to be a profiling of foreign nationals. For example, if there is a crime by a foreign national, there is so much focus on the nationality of the person who is accused of a crime, so much that in communities, the perception is strongly that, in fact, the criminals are foreign.
It sounds like that really feeds these stereotypes. I'm sorry to cut you off, Dewa, but we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Daniel Dunya, Alice Wamundia, Dewa Mavinga, and Adam Harris. Our assistant producers this week are Kyle McCubbin, Minna Tian, and Renee Whistle. Our supervising producer is Edom Kaseye. Visual editor is Benjamin Brink. Takia Thomas is audio engineer. Kathy Kiley is executive editor. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.